Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Franz at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be trying to talk some about the politics of South Africa. We'll look at some of the recent tensions among the leaders of the African National Congress, tensions that resulted in the resignation after almost 9 years of President Thabo Mbeki. We'll also try to talk about the growing dissatisfaction that's voiced by many South Africans when it comes to the economy and also the problems of the poor, as well as violent attacks that took place earlier this year aimed at recent immigrants. We have two guests with us here on the program, Teresa Barnes and Bekisizwe Ndimande. Teresa Barnes is a professor of history and also gender and women's studies here at the University of Illinois. Bekisizwe Ndimande is in the College of Education. He is assistant professor of curriculum and instruction here at the University of Illinois. Both of them grew up in South Africa. Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, Teresa's shaking your head. My apologies. I thought that both of you were born in South Africa. No, you were not. Where were you born?
I was born in Columbus, Ohio.
In Columbus, Ohio. Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry. But you also did some of your academic training in Africa.
I did my graduate work in Zimbabwe, and I lived in South Africa for 17 years and worked at another university for 11, so I'm qualified by some experience, but not by birth.
Not by birth. All right, my apologies.
That's fine.
Professor Ndimande, you were born in South Africa.
Yes, actually, I'm a South African native. I grew up, born and bred in South Africa, then I came to the U.S. when I started to do my graduate school. And I ended up here at Illinois as an assistant professor in curriculum instruction and also a core faculty position with the Center for African Studies.
All right. Well, I'm pleased you could both be here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just as a way of starting out now, it seems that certainly if you go back to the look at the end of the apartheid era, the point where Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa, I think that there was a great feeling of hope that would change South Africa, that people's lives would be improved, particularly people who were on the bottom end of the economic scale, the most disadvantaged people. And certainly now what I read is that there are a lot of South Africans that are really unhappy that more progress hasn't been made. They're not particularly happy with the African National Congress, which has been the party leading now the governments since the end of apartheid, and that people seem really discouraged. There seems to be an awful lot of bad news. The economy is not doing terribly well. There's a big spread between rich and poor. They have serious problems with crime. A lot of people, if they can, are choosing to leave the country. And I wonder what you could say about the mood today in South Africa.
Well, I left South Africa in July, so I'm not sure what the mood today is, with this very day. I think it depends on what kind of time frame one is thinking about. The way that I think about the South African issue is that, as a historian, you have a situation where, metaphorically speaking, poison was poured into the soil for hundreds of years. And comprehensively soaked, you know, the landscape, social poison, personal poison, all kinds of, people like to use the word toxic today. So, and this just didn't just happen once. It happened over a very, very long period of time. And what you get from that is that the things that come up from that soil for a long time are affected by it. So in the short term, you have a set of economic policies that are shaped by the kinds of compromises that were made in the 1990s. Uh-huh. Those were shaped in particular ways that weren't really pointed at dealing with some of the root problems of inequality and exploitation, I think, in South Africa. And that's surrounded then, though, by a culture where other things that, not everything, but other things that come up in the soil are not healthy. One of the last things that you mentioned, was the xenophobia problem. worse than problem, Becky, what's a more serious word than problem? I mean, problem, issue.
Crisis.
Crisis, thank you. And for me, that's one of these manifestations of the of that sort of poisonous atmosphere that, that persists and that probably will persist for a while.
Well, it sounds as if what Professor Barnes is saying, part what I hear is saying is, you know, yes, things, there's reason to be disappointed, but at the same time, you'd have to say, given the how much history that was up to the point of the end of the apartheid, you know, can you really expect it 14 years? Aside from the fact that, you know, maybe the government made some bad decisions, would you really expect that 14 years is enough time for things really to change?
Absolutely, David. I think Professor Barnes here has, I agree largely with what she said. Having grown up in South Africa under apartheid, you know, we shouldn't deny that there have been good changes, progressive changes in terms of the democratically elected government. You know, for example, schools now have been desegregated. You know, we're not talking of integration, but there is a desegregation. Parents with money, they could have a chance, as opposed to previously when you'd be stuck with a bad school in a township. There is a small number of black people who now have access to things. You know, you don't have to carry your passport when you travel, you know. But what I see here now would be the new forms of challenges that are, you know, not only peculiar to South Africa, but new forms of challenges that have, you know, been faced by many countries in the world, you know, issues of corporatization, neoliberal policies that the ex-president Mbeki has, you know, introduced in the country. So those are more like a complicated kind of problems that we are facing right now. But there has been changes, not at the speed that we wanted, but there have been changes.
Well, what other than perhaps one thing you mentioned was the opening of the education system. Well, are there other things that you would point to, because I don't want to be exclusively negative here, other things that you would point to and say, well, yes, there's bad things, and we can talk about bad things, but here are some of the things that I would say truly that this has improved, that this is better than it was before.
Well, I cannot answer that question with dichotomous way and say this is bad. You know, these things are more like a trajectory, so to speak. You know, you find good things, but in the long run, you know, they tend to be counter-hegemonic, or maybe things that start as a counter-hegemonic and as a hegemonic things. Let me give an example here. A question of school choice in South Africa. You have parents who get a chance to go and choose better schools for their kids. Well, in a commonsensical way, this is a good thing to do, right? Take your kid to a school that has good resources. But the long-term effects of those is you lose first collective participation, poor schools in the townships get neglected, right? All resources, you know, although there will be efforts to have parity in resource distribution, but schools that have been ahead for a long time, you know, continue to be ahead. So it's more like a trajectory if you look at this.
I'm thinking of housing, for example. I mean, you see that houses have been built in some of the previously deeply, deeply segregated parts of urban South Africa. There has been some progress there. It simply hasn't been enough. And then you have to look at, for example, in Cape Town, you have to look at the kinds of houses that have been made available. You know, who got the contracts for those houses? What kinds of houses have been built? What quality of houses? If you have a situation where you do make housing available, but it's at a price that people who earn $200 a month can't afford, then you haven't really addressed the problem. So, but I want to say that one of the having just moved from South Africa to the United States, back to the United States recently, in a way I feel a little bit more at home here than I had expected to, because in the United States, it being in an election year, the level of political discussion is very high all the time. People are always discussing politics these days in the United States, and in a way that matches the normal level of discourse in South Africa, where people are always discussing politics and people are always involved in actions and discussions and workshops and papers and teaching and research around the issues of inequality and power and and all of those things are. It's a very vibrant political atmosphere all the time in South Africa. And so the issues that we would be discussing today, for example, you would find are always on the table in South Africa. And what that means is that you find a lot of good ideas and good people and good organizations working very, very hard to find ways to address the challenges. So when we speak of policies that have not lived up to people's hopes in the 1990s, it's not something that people don't know, and that there aren't many really creative people talking about, thinking about, and working on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, failure is defined in many different ways by different people, but it's part of a national dialogue a lot in South Africa, which is one of the things that makes it such an deeply interesting place to live.
Yeah. I'm interested in having you talk about this, the power struggle that seems to be going on now within the African National Congress. And certainly it's something that in our media that has been getting a lot of attention recently. It's not, as far as South Africa is concerned, it's not new. That's been going on for a while. But the big news, I suppose, recently was that the president, Thabo Mbeki, the man who was South Africa's second post-apartheid president, took over after Nelson Mandela, was forced out ahead of time. After almost 9 years, he was president. We now have a placeholder there, but I think that everyone pretty much expects that next year Jacob Zuma will become president of South Africa. And I think the one thing that you read is that there has been tremendous animosity between these two men personally, and between their various supporters, to the point that people are now are talking about, well, maybe there might actually even be a split within the ANC. How are we to understand this? What really is this about? And is this personal, or does this actually reflect some real difference in policy, say, between the two of them?
Dave, I think that's a very good question that you've asked. And actually, I was reading on the news this morning, I heard that one of the person of who resigned from the cabinet, of the new cabinet, is taking now a leadership role in trying to form a new political party that will be a splinter party from the ANC. This is really a very complicated situation in the ANC itself, and as you agree here, I'm not a political pundit, but having lived in South Africa and being familiar with and participated in the political activity there, and I was in South Africa when in December the Polokwane elections took place. It was at that conference, it takes place each and every 4 years, I think, of the ANC convention. It was at that time when really you could see maybe in what I'll call the formation of two camps within the ANC. At that conference, that's when people who were previously in the National Executive Council of the ANC did not get reelected, by the members of the ANC, and the new National Executive of the Council in the ANC tended to get people who were supporters of the current president of the ANC, Jacob Zuma, now. But now let me say just two things about these two people, as you've mm-hmm. asked. The former president, Mbeki, was recalled after he was alleged that after the judgment of Judge Nicholson that he was implicated in Zuma's case. As you know, maybe listeners will know that Zuma has been implicated in a number of cases, including the arms deal. And, you know, so Judge Nicholson found it out and came with a judgment. So President Begi, former president, was implicated in that. And the National Executive Council of the ANC, which is, you know, in a parliamentarian politics, it's actually not the government that rules but would get its policies from the party. So that's how former President Begi was recalled. Mm-hmm. So, and he obliged, he stepped down with, in terms of, being loyal to the party, as it was said. But if I were to take these two people, Thabo Mbeki himself, I will try to be as neutral as I can here, as not taking either of the people's sides. Thabo Mbeki himself was criticized even a few years ago for his policies on HIV/AIDS, in South Africa, how he was more like a denialist, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was in South Africa when I heard him on television said he has never seen somebody who suffered from HIV/AIDS, and that appalled many people. And also his policies of introducing it's called the GEAR, that's the acronym for Growth, Empowerment, and Redistribution, arguing that he will let the rich companies to accumulate capital, and therefore that capital will trickle down to the people, as opposed to what we heard earlier in the presidency of President Mandela, that people will have to have the RDP, which is a redistribution project where the people would, it will be a bottom-up kind of a thing as opposed to a top-down. So, but also, in the meantime, he alienated himself with his own party members and, and on the other hand, Zuma himself has been implicated in a lot of, atrocities. For example, I don't know if you recall the rape case surrounding Zuma 2005, his arms deal thing also, and also he's been implicated with this controversial song that he would like to sing, which kind of threatens the white community in sort of like a bring my arm and, my firearm or stuff like that. So, but for me, that's notwithstanding the importance of personalities and people's history, but for me, really, what is important is, as you've correctly asked, David, that what are the policies? Is South Africa going to be better under Jacob Zuma? Is South African, government going to do much, empowering, policies, implement empowering policies to help the poor people. And if you ask me, I'll say, I don't know. I don't know if President Jacob Zuma will deal with poverty, because I think he has publicly stated that he's not going to change any public policy in terms of how the government was running. So for me, it's a question of the people who've been deprived for many years, how are they going to be addressed? Mm.
One thing that strikes me is I'm not sure that anybody would envy Mr. Mbeki in the sense that he had to come after Nelson Mandela. Because you're always going to be – he is so loved and so revered in South Africa and in the rest of the world. How could you possibly – I wouldn't want to be compared to him. Yeah. Nobody would want to.
Yeah, big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
I was just going to add to what Becky was saying, that how I'm sure soon to be President Zuma will deal with the issues of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. That the liberation struggle in South Africa was not just fought by the ANC, and in recognition of that, it has been governing in an alliance since 1994 with the Congress of South African Trade Unions, which is COSATU, and the South African Communist Party, which is really more like a Social Democratic Party than strictly sort of old-style communist-Stalinist. But those two groups have hitched their wagon onto Zuma, I think because of the manifest failures in the kind of economic policy that Mbeki championed and supported with his set of cabinet ministers, where people at the bottom of the ladder were not. They saw the bottom of the ladder receding above their reach. I mean, it's a statistical fact that as much as we would think, how could this possibly happen, that inequality between the top and the bottom has increased since 1990. There's nothing good that we can say about apartheid, and maybe we can blame this on the policies that were, you know, on the world economy and the way that things were moving in the 1980s and the 1990s finally coming to fruition in the 21st century. Whatever the reason, the economists tell us that the gap between rich and poor has accelerated since 1994. Mm-hmm. So the people whose mandate people like the Congress of South African Trade Unions representing workers and people who would like to be workers in an economy where there's 60% unemployment. They say, you know, the policies that have been implemented have not dealt with this problem. Becky is also very right to say, but this is very complex. This is not a good guy bad guy situation. Zuma has an enormous amount of personal. Things about him that that are not palatable. On the other hand, he was one of the few people in as President Mbeki's deputy who did say populist things and who has an appeal to the section that has been left behind. Therefore, when the Communist Party and Kasatu were looking for someone who would in some way speak their language, they hitched up with Zuma. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they have also then hitched up with the other things that are not palatable. Whether, in fact, he will be able to address those really complicated mm-hmm. issues of poverty and inequality in a world economy where the sky is falling on everyone, really remains to be seen. And if that kind of, to call someone a populist is kind of a criticism. It means that you're saying this for show and not, you know, you don't really feel it all that deeply. We don't know that, and we'll have to wait and see. If you read news, they say that there's a new economic policy there are new economic policies in the works in South Africa. Will Zuma and his cabinet be very sincerely dedicated to trying to address those issues or not? He said no, he's not going to change things. On the other hand, his alliance partners, who have been largely responsible for bringing him now to power and sticking with him through some very thick and thin moments, if they have different policies, how will those power struggles play out? Mm-hmm. We'll begin to see that, I think, next year.
Can I just add two points to that?
Yeah.
I think mm-hmm. that's a very good point you made about Jacob Zuma. As soon as he was elected president of the ANC, he actually took a long, kind of a tour in European countries, going to assure them about the investment that policies will stay the same and, you know, South Africa is open and all that, which is a good thing in many ways. But you also went to, and I read this, that you also went to the G8 meeting, you know, to those powerful people to say that, well, he doesn't intend of changing of any other of the policies in South Africa. So that's, for me, it's a little bit scary when I speak on the side of the poor people.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our two guests, Teresa Barnes and Beck Sizwe Ndimande. Teresa Barnes is professor, associate professor of history here at the University of Illinois, has spent a lot of time living and working as an academic in Africa. And Beck Sizwe Ndimande was born in South Africa, and he's an assistant professor of curriculum and instruction within the College of Education. Both of them have been in South Africa recently. And we're talking here some about South African politics and what has been happening there in the country recently. Questions are certainly welcome. I didn't mention that at the beginning. I certainly should have. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to stay with Mr. Zuma. As you said, I think here in the United States we would say he has some pretty high negatives. There are some problems at including the fact that he was accused of rape, was tried, was found not guilty. I'm sure some people still have some questions about that. There are these questions about political corruption, the allegations that have been raised. And there, of course, as you say, the water has been muddied also by charges that Mr. Mbeki was involved in there and trying to influence perhaps how that was all carried out. That raises questions about...
We have to remember that President Mbeki fired Jacob Zuma as his deputy president 18 months ago, something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose I think the expectation still is that next year Mr. Zuma will become president. But do these things continue to follow him and make it difficult, make his political life difficult?
Mr. Zuma's political life difficult. Yes and no and maybe.
Yes, I think that's a very possible answer.
Yes, because those are very serious issues that just don't disappear. It's not that he has a parking ticket that he didn't pay 30 years ago. Those issues don't disappear. But the South African population does not just have one view on these things. There are people who heard that, you know, when Zuma became the president of the ANC, and therefore one assumes, and I'm, you know, it's 100% chance that he will therefore become the president of South Africa in the next election because he is president of the ANC, and that's the way the rules are. There are people who heard that, you know, when he, you know, and they left the country immediately. Other people in South Africa were very, very happy because he has been one of the few people who has at least had the reputation. And in a way, he has there's this intangible thing of having the common touch. President Nelson Mandela had it in all the best ways possible, and he remains at the age of 90.
He's headed to 90 now.
Just turned 90. He remains, you know, a humorous, humble, charming man. He has the common touch more than I think maybe in some ways anybody I can think of. Mbeki had none of that. He was not good at talking to people. He was not good at reaching out to people. He didn't look good on TV. He didn't sound good on TV. He didn't have any of those things. Zuma, on the other hand, is not in the, I don't know who could be in the Mandela, school of charm, but he is a much more of a people's person and more approachable in that kind of, image sense. So some people, you know, have heard what he said, knows where he comes from. He's a man who literally has come from nothing. He has a very low level of education. I think he only passed primary school. I don't think he went to high school. As you know, many people who were simply not able to pursue their education during the apartheid years, to that segment of the population that was always left out, that's where he comes from, and those are the people that he can and has spoken to, and that's where a great deal of his support comes from. So that was the yes side of my answer, and then the maybe side of my answer is that we simply don't know right now how those different complicated power relationships will work themselves out when he's sitting in the chair, you know, and who will he surround himself with? Who will be giving his advice? Who will his cabinet ministers be? What will he say about, what his priorities are? You know, those things we don't know. There are worrying, depending on your perspective, there are worrying signs, as Becky was saying, around, you know, speaking to one voice, with one voice to European capitalists and another voice to people back in South Africa. I know on another issue, he is very strong, has made some very strong statements about how he feels that the death penalty is something that should be reinvestigated in South Africa. It was abolished in South Africa, unlike in the United States. The death penalty was abolished, and there are people who feel very strongly that the death penalty should be revisited as an issue of deterrence because South Africa has a very high violence and crime level. So that's the maybe part of my answer.
You know, I can add a comment there. I think we shouldn't take the issues of women abuse and rape in a very in a light manner. I think it's a very serious accusation, and you know, given the patriarchy, you know, which really has you know, been defined most society, especially in South Africa, women are very oppressed. They, you know, growing up, my sister will always remind me and say, you know, being a black boy growing up, you are oppressed under apartheid, but not as much as, and I know that not as much as she was at that time. So what the president of the ANC has, you know, involved himself with this would pretty much leave many questions unanswered. But having said that, what we've seen in Polokwane clearly, the people who supported him were more than those who did not. Mm-hmm. I guess what now we need to look at would be how his policies will define his presidency when he ascends to the throne.
Yeah. Well, we have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? We'll talk with them. Someone who is listening in Champagne on our line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd like to know if your guest, what their opinion is about the Democratic Alliance, whether the DA has any power and a role to play. I'd also like to know, we lived in South Africa in 2006, and the word we're getting from people is that they're getting scared, and if kind of what they would recommend for how we can possibly influence our government's interaction with South Africa for the better.
Well, the DA is the acronym for the Democratic Alliance, which is the largest. This is a parliamentary system, so it's the largest party that is in opposition. Alternative, I guess, in a way, to the ANC. Its leader is a woman named Helen Zille, Z-I-L-L-E. Who is both the mayor of Cape Town and the leader of this political party, and it brings together a lot of disparate bits and pieces from the past. There are progressive people in South Africa who say I could never vote for the DA because of its, you know, some, because of its past. It is still marked, I think, by a relationship with some of the old structures of white privilege and some of the assumptions around who should speak and who can't speak. You know, racism isn't something that you defeat in a day or in 14 years. I think that the DA could be more progressive. I think it does have a role to play. I think Helen Zille is a very able and talented woman. I think they struggle to speak to the disenfranchised in South Africa. They have been historically a party of privilege, and they have been struggling to find a language that people will believe when they say they want this and they want that. And they have also not been able to, I think, deal credibly with some of the really difficult issues that have come up. Around your point about people getting scared, it's very difficult to know from the American perspective, what do you say about something like that without sounding like a true alarmist? There, South Africa is a country with a very high crime rate. It's a country with very high levels, as Becky has pointed out, very high levels of domestic violence and gender-based violence. At the same time, it's a country with incredible creative resources. I mean, I brought here, I don't know if we'll have time to talk about xenophobia since we've been on politics, sort of national politics, but I brought in a speech by the, I don't know if Zaki Ahmad is still the president of the Treatment Action Campaign, but it's a speech that he gave to thank people for the work that they did during and after the xenophobic attacks, where he said, you know, this is completely unacceptable, this kind of behavior. But we can't understand it we can't do anything about it unless we understand it. And, you know, we are people who will work and work and work and work and work to try to make the situation better. So, yes, there are some very scary things that happen in South Africa. That said, I found it a very difficult place to leave. Mm. And I'm sure I would think Becky would feel the same way. You know, it's not a place that you would ever want to totally turn your back on.
Well, I will have a different point on that, and I think you've done a good job in answering this. But I wish the caller would have a little bit unpacked what she meant by, worries or, being scary or the DA being scary. But I didn't hear what she meant by that. But South Africa, like any other countries, in the U.S. here, there are places where you have to watch your back. You go to Europe, you go to different countries. And I think there are a lot of people who live in poverty who live this life and they've been living it. And I would be the first one to say that South Africa, I won't be scared to be in my native, given the crime rate. Yes, there is crime rate, but if communities are not working collectively and arguing that they want to leave, then I guess that's what may create some problems. But clearly South Africa is not different from any other country.
Yeah. Just very quickly, and to introduce again our guest, Therese Barnes. She is Associate Professor of History and Gender and Women's Studies at the U of I. Becky Sizwe Ndabandi is in the College of Education. He is Assistant Professor of Curriculum and Instruction. We're talking about South Africa. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I do want to talk about xenophobia. This is something that was sort of our, in fact, something that we set out wanting to talk about. Mm-hmm. And this was something that certainly was in the news a great deal back in the spring. Mm-hmm. Violent, very disturbing, violent attacks against recent immigrants. And these were people that were coming from neighboring countries into South Africa, in some cases because there was political unrest where they were from. In some cases, they were moving to try to find work and improve their economic situation, just like a lot of people have. A lot of people found this really disturbing, and I'm sure a lot of people in South Africa found this really disturbing because they raised this question, well, what does this say? What does this say about who we are and where we are and what's going on here? Let's talk about what it was, what happened.
Well, if I may speak to this, I was in South Africa when this took place. I was living in Pretoria at the time. And in the evening of May 12, 2008, as you rightly pointed out, the residents of Alexander Township near Johannesburg decided to go on rampage and killing, I hate to say foreign nationals, but killing our brothers and sisters coming from other countries. The rationale being, and I'm talking about not what I believe in, but the rationale being they're taking our jobs, they're taking our wives, all those things being more like ridiculous claims. But I also want to quickly put this into a historical context, that this is clearly not a new thing happening in South Africa, except that on May 12th, it happened in a very high scale, brutal, you know. More than 60 people, Dave, lost their lives, and approximately 17,000, you know, brothers and sisters from other African countries were displaced in the cold. And I remember watching on television that night. It was brutally cold in Johannesburg, you know, not as cold as Illinois, of course, but it was cold. But the historical context of this, we have to think back to say, you know, in the early centuries, you know, with the mining industries, there have been those sporadic clashes between migrant miners coming to mine in South Africa, you know, and all that. And in post-apartheid too, you look at the Somali nationals in Cape Town who were, you know, occasionally brutalized and all that. So it's not something that really started on that day. Mm-hmm. In a township of Atrechville and Mamelodi, close to Pretoria, where I lived, you also had those sporadic clashes then. But the historical explanation to this, and then I can just talk really quick that there are a number of things you could talk about there. You go back into apartheid and say, how much is apartheid implicated in this, right? You look at the Group Areas Act of 1953 that really forced the separation of ethnic groups to say, to build this dichotomy between black people to say, you are this, the us-them kind of dichotomy. Mm-hmm. That created a lot of alienation between and among, you know, black people. And that I could say what was one of the historical explanation I could give there, you know, the Bantustan system. But also my second point will be the state violence, you know, that created a violent civil society, you know. That wasn't addressed in the post-apartheid talk. Even the Truth and Reconciliation Commission did not speak about the issues of ethnicity, the issue of gender equality. We were like, rightly so, we're like preoccupied by issues of race, which is all right. So when you look at apartheid, it wasn't just about the physical, but it was also psychological. Mm-hmm. Then my third point will be the post-apartheid unification. You know, it really did not address, you know, issues of poverty, issues of you know, of deprivation and all that. But you cannot talk about unification and just talk about truth. Unification means talking about the whole aspects, your spectrum of human life. And my fourth point here would be also the police brutality of, you know, brothers and sisters coming from African countries. You know, I don't know if listeners, they should know about this already, but in South Africa, if you're black, you could be randomly stopped on the street to produce papers to show that you're South Africa. I think that's a blind violation of the Constitution. Under apartheid, police officers would stop black people to find out if they were at the right time, at the right place. But now it's happening. So I think that really has created that stigma that says, oh, if you're foreign or quote-unquote foreign national, therefore, you are not part of the South African. And the last point that I'm going to make, which for me I think is a very crucial point, would be the question of education. You know, we still, although our curriculum has changed, but it never tried to address issues of, you know, identities, issues of African country, the Balkanization of Africa by colonialism, the Balkanization of South Africa by apartheid. Those issues are never discussed in the curriculum. Mm. And we're still trying, you know, battling to find that. You know, so that's how I could, you know, kind of explain that. And that doesn't mean that those points I mentioned are the laundry list that has caused that. And certainly those are just kind of a thing that can help us explain this phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, anything that you would want to add on to that?
Yeah, to me, the xenophobia problem is probably one of the best examples of what that metaphor I started out with of the poison in the soil. Yeah. It doesn't go away by itself. It has to, you know, you have to work with it. You have to neutralize it. That's why Becky's point. That's what I think Becky was speaking of,
right,
when you're speaking of education. And when we were talking about the complication of the politics in South Africa, there are groups that say, look, first of all, I want to say that here in the United States, I looked it up yesterday. You know, our unemployment rate is about 6%. In South Africa, it's 40%. And in Zimbabwe, the neighboring country just north of South Africa, it's 80%. So people are flowing as they must to try to find ways to survive southward into South Africa. You know, our inflation rate here in the U.S. is 5%. In South Africa, it's 9%. Okay? And in Zimbabwe, one would not believe it. I don't even know how it's possible to measure something, but they say on the internet that it's 11,000,000%. So I mean, it's unimaginable. So you know, we cannot here in the United States. There is no high horse that we can stand on. If we think about the pressures that, as the American politicians are telling us now, the pressures that Americans are under right now, as we speak, on NPR, every morning they're talking about people like this morning can't afford to buy a new refrigerator. Okay, and that's at inflation of 5%. In Southern Africa, this has been going on for much longer, much deeper, and people are under incredible pressures to try to move forward a little bit. So we have no high horse here, as Becky was saying. That said, South Africans in under apartheid, you were trained never to trust anyone that looked anything slightly different than you, that sounded different than you sound in any way. The minute delineations of race and class in South Africa were deep, 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 and so that tradition carries on. You know, it's not something that changes when you change laws. That's the way that people were trained to think about themselves and about other people. I think that carries on. The attacks were awful. They were horrific. They were terrible. The 62 people who you know died in every way, who were killed, who were butchered, who were murdered. It was a terrible time to live in South Africa. Everyone I knew was just more depressed than I think I can explain. And in some ways, still are. The caller that called about people getting scared, you know, a lot of people thought that this was really the end. That said, other people got to work. People took in strangers off of the street. People drove around looking for people to help. But the state, you know, the state response, I was looking at the internet yesterday. You know, given that you have thousands of people who've been driven out of townships because it's those segregated townships where poor Zimbabweans, poor Mozambicans have been forced to live, both economically and because there is nowhere in affluent South Africa that you can set up camp if you are homeless or displaced. You will be pushed out of the leafy suburbs. You will not be tolerated in the leafy suburbs. So it's the townships that have had to absorb immigrants, some of them of long standing and some of them not. They've had to, it's the poorest of the poor who've had to carry the brunt of the burden of the poorest of the poorest of the poor. You know, so once people were pushed out, when they fled the townships, for example, in Cape Town, they were put in camps, but they weren't put in camps in hotels. They weren't put in camps in the convention center, in the middle of town. They were put in camps in tents, in campsites. And anybody who's been in Cape Town in the winter knows that it's not like an Illinois winter where the houses are supposed to heat it on the inside. The wind howls, the rain pours down. It's about 45 degrees, and it is miserable out there on the sand in tents. And that's where both the municipal government and the provincial government, like the state government, that's where they put people. That's where they stayed. And you know, you look at the kind of policies that were tried to implement, they have failed to deal with this issue. So, it's, you know, it's a, it's a, it's a, it's a, It's a terrible problem. It remains a terrible problem. There's still xenophobic violence going on today. And the question is, who can find a solution to those really deep seated problems? Will it come in a cult of personality around Jacob Zuma? Or will civil society have to find once again new ways and new structures to deal with it?
We are essentially out of time, and my apologies. We have someone that we can't take. I'm afraid that there's just really no way we can give them a chance to ask much of a question and to get much of a response from our guest.
So sorry.
No. Don't apologize. I thought you spoke beautifully, and I think I feel it helps me understand. And I'm sure that in future programs we'll be coming back to some of these subjects. Is there any last thought that you might like to leave with folks?
Well,
in about 30 seconds.
Right. I wanted to thank you first when I started to talk, but I forgot. But this is a chance to thank you, Dave, for having us here, and also, talking to the listeners. And I think South Africa now is an important, place to talk about, given the running up to elections in 2009 and with the changes. And we don't know what's going to happen if this new party is formed. So that may, tip the scales, and there may be new politics coming out. So I think this is an appropriate time to talk about it. And thanks for having us here.
Well, I appreciate you very much giving us your time. Becca Siswe Ndimande, he's Assistant Professor of Curriculum and Instruction at the U of I in the College of Education. Teresa Barnes, she is Associate Professor of History and Gender and Women's Studies here at the U of I. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.